Hola, so. So we'll be returning to the text right after this first session. And if you recall where we left off, the author Panchen Rinpoche had just given a very brief, very concise reference to two methods. The first being very familiar, and that is simply observing whatever comes up, letting it be. But the second one I've really not dealt with much in this retreat, where he says whatever thought comes up, cut it right off. And he says like a swordsman, right? So some of you have been listening to podcasts or listening to teachings that I've given over the years. You'll be familiar with the metaphor here, a little tiny bit of a parable. I'll narrate it very shortly. It's very simple. The metaphor here is that of a duel between an archer and a swordsman, right? And the type of swordsman, of course, there are a lot of kinds of swords. There's a sword of William Wallace. I think his sword is about 6 feet long and broadsword. You could cut off three people's head in one stroke. You know, I like that kind. William Wallace, yeah, my forebear. But the other one is like the Three Musketeers. I think it's called a foil. So it's very for very quick work. You skewer them rather than, you know, you shish kebab them rather than decapitate them. That's very French. Whereas the broadsword is very Scottish. Just cut off their heads. It's very straightforward. So this is the French, bien sûr. And so the metaphor, you can visualize it so easily. Give the swordsman a chance here. So maybe they're at 50 paces, maybe 100 paces, right? And so they're squaring off. And it's kind of a one-side battle, really, because the archer has a whole quiver full of arrows. And he gets to shoot them whenever he feels like it. It doesn't have to be every 5 seconds. He can pause for 10 seconds and then shoot off three in rapid succession. The swordsman is entirely defensive. He's not going to throw his sword. So he's there, and just like Rhonda's right in front of me, so I attend. So if Rhonda's a bit too close, if she were an archer, she could skewer me before I could, you know, deflect. But that's the whole idea. If she's maybe 50 paces, 100 paces away, and I'm very intent on her, as if my life depends on it. And she brings the arrow to the bow. She's waiting for me to waver, to blink, to be distracted. When she thinks she has an end, she will loose the arrow. And if I'm right, if I'm very attentive, I will see the moment that she looses the arrow. I will see the moment in which the arrow is in flight. I will have my sword poised, ready to deflect the arrow before it can get to me. Right, and I'll be waiting. So she can wait. She could wait, and then boom, 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 or one, and then, you know, whatever she likes. So there's no telling when she's going to loose the arrow. So it's entirely defensive on the part of the swordsman, but don't get distracted, because then you'll be aware of the arrow after it's already skewered you. A bit too late. Right. So it's a nice metaphor. It's very straightforward, and I think you've already figured it out. What are you attending to? You're attending to the face of your mind. You're attending to the flow of consciousness from which emerge thoughts, desires, memories, emotions, and so forth. And as soon as something comes up, and here's a real point. We're going to go into the practice, and I will give guidance in it. Here's a real point. If this is a very skilled swordsman, it takes very little effort. That is, he has to be very attentive. But when the arrow is in flight and it's just about to get to him, he doesn't need to go, you know, like that, some big, gross movement. It's just like that. Something very subtle and just enough to deflect the arrow. And then that's all that's needed, right? And so similarly, as you're poised there hovering in the immediacy of the present moment, your awareness turned right in upon the mind, this flow of consciousness from which thoughts, desires, memories, and so forth will emerge forth. As soon as you see one coming up, please bear in mind, it takes very little effort to deflect it, to cut it off. It's kind of like a little, it's not big effort, but it's very subtle, it's very precise, and it's exactly, precisely poised in the present moment, right? So that's the quality of awareness. So it's very different ambience than just let it be, let it be. This is not letting be at all. Whatever comes up, deflect it So it gets one moment in the sun, and then it's snuffed out. One moment of flashing in the light of your awareness, and then it's gone. Okay? And then you rest in that stillness, in the absence, in the aftermath of a thought coming up. You simply rest in that silence. But you rest not slacking off, not waiting, but just poised right in the present moment. Aware of what's left over. That is, you still must maintain the flow of cognizance. And Brendan, what are you maintaining a flow of cognizance of? Exactly right. The luminosity and cognizance of your own awareness, that's exactly right. Or I can rephrase it, but in no way different, just you're aware of the flow of consciousness, the flow of awareness itself, with these two distinctive characteristics. So you're not attending to the space of the mind or the events that are going to appear to you. You're right there, ready to note immediately whatever subjective impulse comes up. So these thoughts, emotions, as are called in Tibetan semjung, they're events that emerge from, semjung, mind emergences. They are events that emerge from the flow of the mind. And you see them as soon as they come up, and then, like that. Okay, that's it. So final point, I will give guidance, hopefully not a lot, so you can really be attending to the practice. But I first really kind of immersed myself in this practice when I went down to Sri Lanka after 6 months in India in retreat. And I remember this was 1980, so it was just 4 years earlier Geshe Rabdhan had taught it. And I remember so vividly, like it was yesterday, what I did. I was living in a little hermitage up in the mountains outside of Kandy. I was doing this practice. And you can't see, but listening by podcast, you can't see, but everybody else, watch very closely. I'm about to do what I did then, 36 years ago. Okay, I will actually do it. Did anybody see any problem with what I just did? That could be a problem. Yeah, breathing would be such a distraction. Like, there's no time to breathe. It could come up when I'm breathing out. What do I do then? I'll not breathe. That'll work out fine, I'm sure. Yeah, that's very easy to do. You get so intent that you just suppress quietly, unconsciously. You suppress the breathing. Bad idea. Bad idea. And it's not only in this practice. I've often told of this professor at Stanford that I saw in a video where he asked everybody in the audience, bring out your smartphones and check your email. And why 300 people did this. After they did it, he said, okay, how many of you were holding your breath? And it was like lots. Checking email. Oh, what's going to be? Oh. Very common. Really unhealthy. Okay? So it all the more emphasizes settling body, speech, and mind sequentially, coarse to subtle. And all the way through, that breath just flowing like you're on a vacation in Tahiti. No worries, just breathing in, breathing out. Like that. As relaxed as Tahiti and as sharp as a blade. Well, that's so. Get comfortable. With the motivation to penetrate through to the sign of your own mind, to that indwelling joy and sense of well-being that emerges from the ground state of your awareness, as I step along the path to full awakening, for the sake of all sentient beings, arouse such a motivation. With that motivation, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. Let your eyes be gently open, evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you for a very short time. Simply rest, sustaining this flow of mindful presence without an object, without doing anything, without meditating on anything. Simply sustaining the flow of mindfulness without distraction, without grasping. Then invert your awareness right in upon consciousness itself, this flow of awareness. From which emerge all discursive thoughts, memories, desires and emotions, all subjective impulses, non-conceptually. Attend to this flow of awareness itself. And as soon as some mental activity emerges from this non-conceptual flow of luminosity and cognizance, cut it off immediately. And sustain the flow of awareness, of cognizance, of what continues on in the aftermath of the mental emergence that occurred. Of central importance is to maintain the flow of cognizance, non-conceptually, non-conceptually aware of a non-conceptual flow of awareness. To maintain such fine tune, such precise, utterly present-centered, discerning awareness. For this to be sustainable, there must continue to be a deep sense of ease, of looseness and relaxation in the body. Your body should be still like a mountain. The breath should flow as effortlessly and as unimpededly as if you were deep asleep. Let's continue practicing now in silence. And so we return to the text. And right now we're looking at the root text. So just to read again the last verse very briefly that was covered yesterday, extremely concisely, focusing on these two methods, kind of yin and yang. Whatever thoughts arise, identify each one. So there's more passive. Alternatively, like a swordsman, immediately cut off any thought that comes up. Obviously more yang. So then we continue. When you are resting after they've been cut off, without losing mindfulness, loosely relax. And then the aphorism is, tightly focus and loosely relax. It is there that the mind is settled. So that's an aphorism from the Mahamudra tradition on Shamatha. So I won't comment a lot here. He's going to give his own commentary, but it's very important, and that is once a thought arises and you do nip it in the bud, just cut it right off, that you're not waiting. The word wait should never enter into this practice, because waiting already is sending your mind to the future in anticipation of something that may or may not occur, which means you're not here. So the notion of waiting never happens in this practice, authentically. Because you're getting, it's like instant gratification. And that is, what you want to do is be right in the present, being fully attentive, and you're doing it right now, so you're totally satisfied. So it's instant gratification, right? That's that. That's nice. But this means as soon as a thought has come off, you're totally on. And you are totally present, sustaining the flow of cognizance of what remains after the thought has been snuffed out. And of course, that is precisely that flow of luminosity and cognizance. So without losing mindfulness. But then, don't be freezing up. It's very easy to do. Don't be tense. Don't get your continuity that way. That's the old-fashioned way that leads to burnout. But as you're doing this is where you have to have that core, really kind of an existential sense of looseness, of relaxation, of ease, without losing mindfulness, without losing stability, without losing the continuity of focus, attention, loosely relax. And now we see this theme, and it's clearly common both to the Dzogchen as well as the Mahamudra traditions, the oscillation. Tightly focus and loosely relax. It is there that the mind is settled. Okay? So it's not just Padmasambhava. This is really quite generic in the Dzogchen Mahamudra traditions. So it is said. So as I said, that's an aphorism, a well-known aphorism in the tradition. Cherkitela, lucky lu. So easy. Everything is shorter in Tibetan. Very concise. So it is said, and elsewhere it says, here's another aphorism coming up, this mind bound by entanglements no doubt attains freedom when relaxed. So, it's like, can't remember exactly what the image is, but if you're snared and you struggle, the snare tightens up on you, and you struggle more, and after what, you're just totally frozen and locked in totally. And the only way to release is, the only way to get out of the snare is by totally loosening up. Well, that's exactly this here. Okay, no doubt the mind attains freedom when you loosen up. And how do you do that? By releasing all the grasping. It was the grasping that bound you up in the entanglements in the first place. As taught here, you should relax without distraction. So, very pithy. Another verse. Whenever thoughts arise, if their essential nature is observed, they naturally disappear and a clear vacuity arises. So we're back to method one, simply observing whatever thought comes up. And I've changed the translation a lot here. Whenever thoughts arise, if their essential nature is observed, there are two terms here in Tibetan, ngo and rangjin. And this is the ngo, it's the essential nature. Essential nature, and Ranjin is, I've changed the translation a lot here just because I think it's an important distinction and it didn't come through in the translation. Ranjin is manifest, a manifest nature. And the essential nature is right down to the core, not talking about intrinsic nature or inherent nature, which doesn't exist at all. But we can say that the essential nature of consciousness, bare bones, cut back to its kind of raw core, luminosity and cognizance. It's not to say they're inherently existent, but if you cut them out, then you don't have consciousness anymore. You can cut out an awful lot of the padding, you know, the coverings, the cloakings, the configuration. You can cut them out. Conceptualizations, memories, fantasy, gender-oriented thoughts, and so on. You can cut that out. But if you should cut out luminosity or cognizance, then the baby killed the baby. You know, throw out all the bathwater you like, but if you throw out that, then the baby's gone. So that's the essential nature. One says the essential nature of fire is hot. If it's not hot, it's not fire. It's burning. If it's not burning, it's not fire. Right? Now, there are many types of flame. There are blue flame, yellow flame. There are blow torches. There are candles. There are suns. There are nuclear explosions. There's all kinds of ways that the fire element manifests. Right? Those are the manifest nature. Right? But the essential nature is if you take that away, then you don't have one. So this becomes very important when observing thoughts. And that is, we observe the manifest thought. Oh, that's a thought about the vacation my family had when I was 14 and we were traveling all over Europe in a VW van. I remember my grandma was there. I got caught in the narrative. That's a manifest. That was the story. That was the memory. Taking me down memory lane, right? That's the manifest nature. How is it displayed? What are its distinctive, this particular thought? Oh, that's a memory from my perspective, only I have. My siblings and my parents and my grandma were in the van altogether. But my perspective is unique. So that's manifest, right? There's not a whole lot to be learned about that unless you want my biography. But in this practice, we're not interested in personal narrative. This is quite an impersonal practice. It's not like I want to get to know myself better. Bullshit. Why? You're going to be dead soon. What's the big deal? Why are you interested in this short story? It's going to be over anyway. What's the big deal? Why not worry about the essential nature? If anything continues on, it's not going to be your story. It's going to be something much more raw, primitive, primal than that. You might think along the lines of luminosity and cognizance. Now, if that continues, and you fathom that, that could be meaningful all the way through. All the way through life, all the way through dying process, through beyond the dying process. That's a keeper. That's essential nature. So whatever thought comes up, simply observe its nature, the thought as a thought, not as a thought as my thought about this event with these people and blah, 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 but just a thought as a thought, an emotion as an emotion, a desire as a desire, without even labeling it. Just see it naked. Gone, here, gone. Okay, keep it clean, keep it simple. If their essential nature is observed, which means you're not cognitively fusing with it, otherwise, if you are, then you're not observing it, you're not getting caught up in the drama, otherwise you're identifying with it. If they're essential, see, he's packed a lot into these few words, and it's much shorter in Tibetan. Whenever thoughts arise, if their essential nature is observed, they naturally disappear. They They arise by themselves, they disappear by themselves. They naturally disappear. And in their wake, upon their disappearance, this is as you're tending the space of the mind and whatever comes up, upon the vanishing, the disappearance of the mental event, the thought, the image, and so on, a clear vacuity arises. Okay, space of the mind, clear as in the sense of having no appearances in it. Sustain the cognizance of that. Likewise, if the mind is examined when it is still, so if you're observing, if you're inverting right in upon the mind, upon that which is observing, right? It's your unflickering candle flame. The candle flame is inverting in upon itself, illuminating and knowing itself. If you do that, if the mind is examined when it is still, a vivid, unobscured, luminous vacuity is perceived. That awareness is not in a tight space. It's not a point. It's not inside your head. It's not inside a pea. It's not confined. And so as you're attending to that, then a sense of space may also arise, as he says. A vivid, unobscured, so we think back to Gache's comment, it is unobscured indeed. Luminous, it's by nature bright as your own awareness. Vacuity, that awareness itself is empty. That's the thing. That awareness itself has no content. That awareness itself has no referent. It's not about something else. It's just resting in its own nature, right? So it's clear, it's empty of any referent. It's not about anything. And that is perceived. This is known as the fusion of stillness and movement. So there's that Very familiar phrase by now. Ne yu zunjuk. Again, it's always shorter in Tibetan. Ne yu zunjuk. And zunjuk means union, fusion, coming together, convergence even. So I think what he's getting at here in this context is he's saying you may be observing thoughts, that kind of that yin approach, is observing thought, observing their essential nature, they vanish, and then a clear vacuity arises. But of course that clear vacuity is suffused by your awareness. Otherwise you wouldn't be aware of it. Right? That's what you wind up with. Right? On the other hand, if you invert your awareness right in upon the mind, observing when it is still, and you penetrate through that, and you don't tighten up, you don't constrict into thinking somehow the mind is something small, the mind a point, the mind is confined, but you observe it free of concepts, you come to that same vacuity, which is indivisible from the luminosity of your own awareness. So it's like two different approaches. They are different approaches. Right? One's observing the other, one's just cutting them off. That's not the same. But he's saying, when he says, speak of the fusion or the union of stillness and movement, I think he's saying these two approaches converge in upon the same point. Okay. Whatever thoughts, so now we're back to method one. We'll just call it that, method one. Whatever thoughts arise, do not block them. Do not block them. But recognizing their movements, focus upon their, what did I call it before? Their essential nature. Focus upon their essential nature. Again, their manifest nature would be, oh, I was thinking about my, it was something you might tell to a therapist, or a person who's going to analyze your dreams. I had a dream last night. This was the story. Oh, I just had a wandering thought. I just had an emotion come up. I just had a memory come up. Let me tell you about it. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing trivial. But it's something different. Because it's telling you about the content. Oh, tell me, what was your thought about? What was the emotion about? What was your dream about? Good, no problem. That's not bad. That's manifest nature. But here we're cutting right to the core of it, the essential nature. We're not interested in the referent. We're not interested in the storyline. We're just observing the mental event as a mental event, just keeping it that simple. Right? So, whatever thoughts arise, do not block them, but recognizing their movements, their comings and going, focus upon their essential nature. Like the analogy of a raven on a ship. Just as a raven that flies, and here's the aphorism, just as a raven that flies from a ship circles in every direction and alights there again. Okay? I've told this metaphor many times, but not necessarily everybody's heard it. And so I'll tell it now, but I'll try to keep it quite short. This is, again, classic parable. And the parable is actually reality-based, and that is in olden times, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 years ago, maybe longer. The Indians were seafarers back during the time of the Buddha himself. They were the seafarers. They were heading out on their ships onto the high seas and making their way to the Near East, to Alexandria, to Cairo, or whatever, Alexandria, and so forth. And so, but of course, they didn't have the star charts, they didn't have the navigation devices that were later developed. And so when they were far out at sea, and they're running short of supplies, especially water, then at some point they know we've got to get water fast, otherwise the crew's going to die, we'll all be dead. And so as part of their navigation tools, they would cage raven, one or probably more than one raven. Don't want you to get sick and die. So they would cage ravens, crows, same word in Tibetan, jaro, and they would cage them as they set out on the high seas. And then when they are really running short of supplies, they need to find landfall soon, like within a day or two. Otherwise, they could be in deep trouble. Then they would release one of the ravens. And very important, they're releasing a raven, not a seagull or a duck. They're releasing a bird that cannot swim in the water. And the bird knows it cannot swim. If it lands in the water, it knows it's going to die. A wet raven is a dead raven on the high seas. Right? And so they release the raven. Well, you can imagine the raven's been cooped up there for days or weeks. The raven takes off. And the clever thing about this is the navigator knows the raven wants what everybody on the boat wants. Where's the nearest land? Now, if you're right on the surface of the ocean, what I've been told is you can see about 10 miles. The horizon's about 10 miles away. That's not very far. But a raven, what's the smart raven? They're very smart birds. What's a raven going to do? I'm making this a long story, but it's a cool story. What's the raven going to do? They're smart birds. The raven's not going to just, hover against the waves and say, I think, meeny-miny, I'm kind of feeling west. We're not stupid, you know. The raven's going to be smart, and the raven's going to go straight up. Because the higher you go, the farther the horizon. The raven got that figured out. So the raven's just going to circle up, 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 as far as it can go until it sees land. As soon as it sees land, it wants what the navigator wants. It's going to make a beeline and head right for the land. That's where food is, drink, and freedom, right? And then, of course, the navigator is watching that raven with intense curiosity. Because if it gets very high and it turns into a dot and the navigator's attention wanders, get the next raven. You know? You blew it. You just blew one of your ravens. So don't let your mind wander. But of course, don't shoot the raven. Keep that archer at home. Don't mess with the raven. Don't throw breadcrumbs in the water. Just watch the raven and don't get distracted. Because if that raven takes off, hard a port, follow that raven. Because you can be very confident that raven is heading in a direction that it saw, which is also the direction you want. But now, alas, in this metaphor, the raven goes up and up, circling around higher and higher and higher. But alas, even if it goes up a mile, it still sees no land. And so what does the raven do? The raven is faced with a decision. I can either commit suicide and just go off and bye-bye world and just, you know, Gaia, until he just kind of gets exhausted and falls into the sea and dies. That's a possibility. Or he can come back to this, the lesser of two evils, and come back to the boat, which he really doesn't want, but it's better than dying. So what the raven will do is circle up, 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 disappointed raven, circles down, 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 and lands on the mast. From that from which it arose, to that it returns. The thoughts emerge from the space of the mind. They circle around, they tell their story. Maybe it's a short story, maybe it's a long story. But in this very yin approach, this very passive approach, you don't mess with the story. You don't alter it, you don't prolong it, you don't censor it, you don't block it. Don't mess with it any more than the navigator is messing with the raven, but he's certainly watching very closely. Right? And then, as the thought emerges from the space of the mind, the thought having nowhere else to go, I wish they did, I'd give all mine away. Mary Kay, have a ton of thoughts. I've got some excess. Doesn't work that way. Having nowhere else to go, the thought comes and dissolves back into the space of your own mind from which it arose. And you watch, if you're really on and you're very soft, very relaxed, like the navigator who's just watching, you can actually watch the thought emerge. You can be lucid from the first moment it arises. Watch the thought circle around, whether it's 3 seconds or 30, but with no grasping, no preference, no identification, no perpetuation or termination. It circles around, it tells its story, like overhearing somebody talk in the adjacent room, or just like hearing some speech on the radio. You're just not part of it at all. And then it just fades out. And you just watch it, and then the thought comes and dissolves right back in the space of the mind. That's the metaphor. Okay? Very passive. Very passive. And very different, of course. Diametrically different to cutting them off as soon as they come up. Okay? So now we have these two metaphors. The duel between the swordsman and the archer, and the navigator and the raven. Two nice, very nice metaphors. Okay, so now we go to his commentary. As for the nature of the concentration, the term samadhi, which I really like the word samadhi, he's translating quite correctly as concentration, so I'm just keeping to that. As for the nature of concentration, of the concentration to be accomplished, samadhi has two limbs. The power of clarity, clarity also means luminosity, so there's one, and single-pointed non-conceptuality. So these are the two elements. Power of clarity, hyphen luminosity, and single-pointed non-conceptuality. Bear in mind, non-conceptuality is not just spacing out and having no thought. Single-pointed non-conceptual cognizance. That's not what it says here, but that is certainly implied. Such authentic serenity, again, serenity being his translation for shamatha, such an authentic shamatha must have both of these two. It must have the power of clarity, otherwise it's just dullness, stupor. And it must be single-pointed, otherwise it's not samadhi. And it must be non-conceptual, otherwise it's not turning into shamatha. Such authentic shamatha arises from single-pointed concentration of a desire realm mind, a mind that is embedded in, is at home in the desire realm versus the form realm or formless realm. Such authentic shamatha arises from single-pointed samadhi of a desire realm mind of one on a stage that is not yet complete equipoise. Equipoise is nyamchak in Tibetan. I prefer meditative equipoise, but equipoise is certainly fine. So there is some degree of balance, this meditative equipoise, free of the extremes of laxity and excitation, but is not yet complete. You don't have that really sublime, extremely fine-tuned balance of having achieved shamatha, in which case your mind slips over from being a desire realm mind and crosses the threshold to becoming a form realm mind. Okay? The guardian, or the protector Maitreya, says it arises from a cause that is abandonment of the five flaws, and a reliance on the eight, I'm translating as interventions. Eight interventions. I think he said engagements. That's certainly not incorrect. I simply prefer. So, I just want to list these shortly. Anybody who studied Lamrim, you know exactly where to go. My doctoral dissertation at Stanford was now called Balancing the Mind. It has Tsongkhapa's complete presentation of shamatha. It covers all of these five powers, the eight interventions, the four types of mental engagement, all definitively laid out. It's laid out, of course, in the Lamrim Chemo, the Great Exposition, Volume 3, has extensive discussion on that. So it's all there, and it's in Gyanlam Rinpoche's book, Calming the Mind. So there's no reason to really linger here. We could spend a day on this very easily. So I'm just going to list the five flaws or five faults. Either way is fine. They are, and they're interesting, and you'll have these, you know, you'll have these this, by this evening. Spiritual sloth. I translated it as spiritual sloth and not just laziness. I think it's Acadia in Latin. The Christian contemplatives use this term a lot. Acadia. I'll just give briefly the three types. We could linger here. I just want to go bum bum like stiletto. Three types of spiritual sloth. It's lelo in Tibetan. There is jawangenjingi lelo, and this is why I say spiritual sloth, because the first one hardly anybody would regard as laziness. Jawangenjingi lelo is the spiritual sloth of fixating on jawangimba, negative activity. Well, negative activity in this context means the pursuit of any mundane concerns. Money, fame, wealth, reputation, these are not evil. But if you're a shamatha practitioner, these are definitely not on the positive side of the ledger, they're on the negative side, they're complete distractions. And so people, from this contemplative perspective, from the perspective of a person who's committed to entering the path and proceeding on the path, looking from that perspective, if you, for example, in California, you go to Silicon Valley and you find people with their startups and they're working 16-hour days and they're just burning the candle at both ends and they're working incredibly hard. For what? To financial success, coming out with a good product, fame, reputation, and more success and more money, and so forth. You say, well, that's a great big exercise in spiritual sloth. Because all of that's going to be worth nothing when you're dying. However many products you've made, I mean, for other people, maybe there's benefit. If you had a motivation to be a benefit, then it's dharma, that's good. But if it's just basically, I'm going to start up a company because I want to be rich and famous and powerful and influential, and that's my motivation, well, you maybe succeed, maybe you won't. But whether you succeed or not, everything you're doing is completely a waste of time. Dharmic perspective. And we judge that by when you're facing death, now what? Does it matter how much you have, how many people love you, respect you, how famous you are, how many Facebook friends you have, and so forth? All it means is they're going to have one less Facebook friend. That's all it really means, really. And so that's one type of laziness, fixation on mundane concerns, and it could be 16-hour days, you know, workaholic, and you're still just a lazy bum. From a dharma perspective, that's one. Ranyikarsa, giklupe leo. That's the one we all resonate with. Giklupe lelo is just the laziness of lethargy, of just, I don't feel like it, you know, kind of the couch potato. Just I just don't feel the initiative like that. And then ranyikarsa, niepe lelo. This is self-effacing laziness. It's an interesting one. It's not humility. Not humility. His Holiness Gyatso Rinpoche, so many of the great lamas, I know they all, basically all of them, they're incredibly humble. But there's no self-effacement. Self-effacement is the lack of self-worth. The sense that, well, why should I even try to practice Shambhala? I know I'm not going to accomplish it. How many people accomplish? Why should I be special? I'd probably waste my time. I would never get anywhere. Why should I try to learn Tibetan? It's really hard language, very different. I'd never get it anyway. And you know, just that. You come up with any idea, but I probably can't do it. And sometimes that masquerades as humility. It's just laziness. So those are the three types of laziness. So that's longer than I intended to spend, but those are kind of important. Now we'll move quickly through the other ones. So first one is spiritual sloth. Forgetting the practical instructions. So you receive them, I give the guided meditation, and then afterwards what? In one ear, out the other. Don't have a clue. Okay? Then what was the point? Listen to recording. I don't need to be here. I can sit at home in my little meditation hut. If you forget them, what's the point? Laxity and excitation, those you know well. Non-intervention. This is why I use the word intervention. Non-intervention, and that is when laxity or excitation arise, if you don't do anything about it. You just go, oh, I'm supposed to be, as they say in the, you know, the mindfulness movement. So my mind is becoming very lax. My mind is very has a lot of excitation. But I just have to accept it all. I just have to be here now, whatever's coming up. I shouldn't be judgmental. If my mind is lax, I just say, well, I wouldn't want to judge your mind. Heaven's bit, you might object. And if you're getting really excited, you know, completely rambling, well, yeah, but it's okay. It's okay. You know, let's be friends. Bullshit. That's non-intervention. You should have done something about stupid. That's not the practice. That's just stupid. It's just falling into the same ruts and being complacent about it. And you're calling this a spiritual practice? Why? There is a bit of sarcasm. If you're not aware of sarcasm, I'm being sarcastic right now. This is vintage sarcasm. So that's non. When you should be intervening, you're not. Because you have some cockamamie notion that you're supposed to be non-judgmental all the time. I'm very judgmental of being not judgmental. I think it's bullshit. And then this is up on stage 8 out of 9 stages preceding shamatha. We know in stage 8, neither subtle laxity nor excitation arise at all. They just don't happen. And if you're still there as an eager beaver watching for them, intervening, introducing introspection, are they there? Are they there? It's kind of like, hey, eager beaver, give it a rest. It's okay, the storm's over. Chill. Give your introspection a gold watch, tell them to retire, because everything's fine. So don't intervene when there's no need to. That's non-intervention is a fault. Intervention is a fault, depending on the time. These are regarded as the 5 faults. Those are the 5 faults. And then we have, so those are faults, right? And then we have the 8 interventions. So we have the basis, the 8 interventions, the basis, is specifically yearning for samadhi, and that's cognitive, has to do with aspiration. If you don't wish to develop your attention skills, you're not going to. That's the first thing. If you don't want to, you're not going to. And then the second one is that which is dependent upon it, and that's striving. If you give no effort to it, if you don't sit down and actually implement any of the teachings, you're not going to get anywhere. You just have this, I'd like to achieve shamatha. I'm not going to do anything about it, but I like it if it just lands on my head. Well, okay. That's the second one, striving. The third one is the cause of that. Why would you strive? It's very, very, very smart. This goes back to Asanga, I believe. The cause of that, what is the cause of striving? It's faith. Faith in the teachings, faith in the method, faith in yourself. Call it faith, call it confidence, call it trust. But if you don't have that, then you won't strive. If you think these teachings are just nonsense and nobody's ever achieved it anyway, and even if I tried, I wouldn't make it, then you won't strive. So there has to be some confidence or faith. Okay, that's the third one. And then there's the result. These are the types of interventions. And that's pliancy. This is that prashrapta, the pliancy, suppleness, buoyancy, the malleability of your mind. That's what comes out of this. The fifth one of the interventions is not forgetting the meditative object. So that would be coarse excitation if that happens. The sixth one is recognizing laxity and excitation. The seventh one is intervening to eliminate them when they do occur. And the eighth one is when laxity and excitation are calmed, there is tranquility. Tranquility is the time when you do not intervene, you give it a rest. You're tranquil, you just be at rest. Job finished. You basically cruise to the finish line if you continue practicing shamatha. Quite effortlessly, you move from stage 8, stage 9, and achieve shamatha. So those are the 8 interventions, and we're finished with those. And again, you can get lots and lots of commentary. They're all over the place. So then we return to Panchen Rinpoche's commentary. He said, it is taught that the mind that arises through reliance on the 8 interventions that are antidotes to the 5 flaws, so you can match those up, is accomplished through the 9 stages, which I've referred to many times, and you have that whole word file on the 9 stages and the bullet points, the powers by which they're achieved, and so on. Those 9 mental stages are also taught by Arya Asanga in the treatises on the stages. So I'm almost certain that refers to the Bodhisattva Bhumi, his treatise on the stages of the Bodhisattvas, or the grounds, the Bhumis of the Bodhisattvas, and the Shravaka Bhumi. Do you recall? I think there's just 2. Do you remember, Glenn? Is there anything more? Is that it? I think that's probably it. So, and they are as accomplished through the 6 powers. So we'll call those out as well. Those 6 powers, by the way, are included in that word file I gave everybody. But they're very simple. Here they are. The 6 powers are, first of all, hearing. And that is hearing. This is the old-fashioned, which is an oral lineage. It goes back for thousands of years in India. You don't start out with reading. You start out with hearing from somebody who knows what he or she is talking about. You hear the instructions. Having heard about them, the second power, and from that comes the understanding of hearing. I know what the person said. I understood. I understand what the person said. I understand what the instructions are. But now as you integrate them, you go to a deeper level of understanding, and that's the power of thinking, reflecting upon, considering. So the power of thinking is the third one. So now you've really got it. You have the understanding from hearing, you have the understanding from thinking, and now it's time for meditation, and for that you need to draw on the third power, which is mindfulness. You know what that is. The fourth power is introspection. You know what that is. The fifth one, which really gives you that oomph for the staying power to get all the way to the finish line, is the power of enthusiasm. And the sixth one is the power of familiarity. When you get up there to stage 8, you don't really need enthusiasm. You just cruise. You just cruise. Float on through. Okay? So those are the 6 powers. So those 9 stages are accomplished through the 6 powers and possessing, as accomplished through the 6 powers and possessing the 4 kinds of mental engagement. The way you engage with a meditative object, there are 4, and they are, and then we'll be finished. The 4 mental engagements are, first of all, focused engagement. This is right at the very beginning. When, before you go into the main practice, your mind is probably wandering here and there, a bit of fuzzy, a bit of noise, a bit of activity. And then you give it a task, like having a dog that's just wandering on the yard, and you say, okay, sit. And then the dog runs away, or whatever the dog does. But you've just given it a task, you know, sit. So there's something to do. So watch. Sensations of the fluctuations of the breath throughout the body. Okay, there it is. Do it. Focus. Okay, that's it. Simple. Engage with the meditative object. Focus engagement. But then as you do so, the first thing you discover is that you're not there for very long. Just like when I was growing up, my dog would sit for about 3 seconds, then it would say, that was boring, and go and do something else. And so that's called, the second type is interrupted engagement. Interrupted. You've given your mind a command, and it follows it for 3 seconds, and then it's off into coarse excitation, or coarse laxity, or medium excitation, or subtle. Any of those is a type of interruption to the flow of pristine flow of mindfulness. So even subtle laxity and excitation, they're still interrupted. Right? And so, but when you get to stage 8, this notorious stage 8, then the flow of your mindfulness, flow of samadhi, is uninterrupted even by subtle laxity and subtle excitation. So that's the point in which you have uninterrupted engagement. And then, there's, it said, at the very beginning of the session in stage 8, very beginning, like like the sleds that are used in the Olympics, a little bit of effort just to get them over the lip, and then down they go. And nobody's hopping, you know, getting on the back of the sled and trying to push it downhill, because you're already going 30 miles an hour, right? But it takes a little bit of effort at the beginning, and then like that, just like that. The beginning of the session, a little nudge to engage with a meditative object. Then as soon as you're in, then for the rest of the session, 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever, effortless and impeccable. So that's effortless mental engagement. So it's uninterrupted, but takes a little bit of effort on stage 8. Stage 9, the difference between stage 8 and stage 9 is it doesn't take any effort to get in. It's effortless in, effortless out, effortless maintaining. It's all effortless. And that's how you cross the finish line to shamatha, effortlessly. So it has a nice ending. It has a happy ending. Okay. Four kinds of mental engagement. Back to the commentary. So we're kind of moving on briskly now, because a lot of this you'll be familiar with. Well, focusing on what sort of object, what does one cultivate? Concentration. Again, the word gomba doesn't always mean meditate on. It doesn't make, you're not meditating on concentration as if that's your object. You're cultivating. You're cultivating concentration. So what sort of object does one, on what sort of object does one cultivate concentration? His answer, in general, the Blessed One, the Buddha, the Bhagavan, taught countless objects for accomplishing flawless concentration, such as, and he's just giving a list here, we'll not go into it, it'll take us forever to get through it, such as pervasive objects, objects that purify, those be the kasinas, by the way, the kasinas of earth, water, fire, air, and so forth. You start out small and it goes pervasive. Such as pervasive objects, objects that purify analysis, objects for the wise, that's actually the scholarly or the pundits, objects that purify mental afflictions. I really prefer that over defilements. It doesn't mean defile, it means affliction. Objects that purify mental afflictions, and so forth. However, so there's a wide variety. However, the previous gurus of this instruction lineage, now we're back to Mahamudra, let's get focused here. There's an awful lot out there, but we're going to be very selective to the types of shamatha that are strongly emphasized in this Mahamudra lineage. The previous gurus, the former gurus, the lineage gurus of this instruction lineage usually explain that one should focus on the mind and then identify it. So that same way of explaining concentration also will be used here. So it's and these great scholars, they really choose their words carefully. I noticed this early on when I started studying Tsongkhapa, Benjamin Boche, Dujum Lingpa, Padmasambhava. They use words like scalpels. I mean, they really do tend to be very precise, and he is here. There's a difference between focusing on something and identifying it, right? If you've never seen an orange before, or anything else could be an orange. If you've never seen that, if you've never seen it before, you could look right at it, and you're seeing something orangish and round, and it's going to like, I don't know whether that's a paperweight or a football, but I am focusing on it to identify it as something more. Okay, it's not just you have a label for it. You can always call it a round orange ball. You can always give a label, but what is it? Oh, it's an orange. So you can focus on the mind. You can focus on the spirit, on the space of the mind, not really identify it. You can focus on awareness itself and not really identify it. Have you identified its salient features, its defining characteristics? Have you identified what is unique about this phenomenon that you're attending to that sets it apart from computer programs? Silicon chips, neurons, robots, and so forth. Have you identified what is distinctive here? And this, as we've seen, with the earlier reference this morning about identifying the sign of the mind, if you've gotten the sign of the mind, you've really identified its core, right? And I would say again that the avenue to that, the breadcrumbs, the fragrance, is follow the flow of luminosity and cognizance. Take that right down to its source as your mind, which is derivative, secondary, not essential. Your mind evaporates away. And you've just followed the scent, the fragrance of luminosity and cognizance right to the source. It'll take you right to the substrate consciousness. Because the luminosity that you're attending to right now, where's it coming from? Well, not neurons, not photons. It's coming from the luminosity, which is a core distinctive quality of the substrate consciousness. Right? And cognizance, well, that's right there. It's coming from the substrate consciousness. Cognizance doesn't arise from neurons. It's a crazy idea that everybody, so many people are accustomed to now. And they're just assuming because other people said it, somebody must actually know that to be true. It's one of the biggest hoaxes in the history of science, that neurons know something. It's bizarre. But if you only think physical, it's kind of like that's the best candidate. It's like if nobody else is running for president, vote for Trump. If you want either anarchy or Trump, you might consider Trump. Maybe I've shown my hand. I'm not a really big fan of his in terms of his being a politician. But if you've actually ascertained the essential nature, the defining characteristics, what makes consciousness consciousness, and in so doing you see it where it comes from, and what its nature is, and how it influences other phenomena, like illuminating all appearances. If you've ascertained that from the very beginning, you'd never become a materialist. It would be impossible. You just start laughing. You say, you've got to be kidding. People believe that? That's why, you know, I'm not sure, I'm not respectful at all to materialism. It strikes me just such so much nonsense that I'm amazed that so many people take it seriously. But it's for very good reason. They haven't ascertained the nature of consciousness. Philosophers, psychologists have something like 200 definitions of consciousness. Of course, they don't agree with any of them. And I've checked out some of them. I just found them completely useless. They're nice intellectual exercises. But none of them that I've encountered would actually give you a clue of how to recognize consciousness when you saw it. I've heard of one, he's a very smart psychologist, a very nice fellow as well. So I have no criticism of the people who advocate these views at all. But he gave this very elegant, very intellectual, utterly abstract, completely intellectual definition of consciousness. He was very happy with it. But I thought, if I didn't know what consciousness was, and I use your definition, I'd never know it when I bumped it into it. It would be completely useless. But then if I give you a definition of orange or a pineapple, and you go to the grocery market and you've memorized my definition, and it doesn't give you any idea at all how to recognize a pineapple when you see one, what on earth was that definition good for? And I feel the same thing is true for consciousness. If the definition doesn't help you, when you focus on it, identify it, then it's useless. It doesn't matter how elegant it is. And the fact that none of these definitions agree with each other is rather telling. So this is a very crucial point. He chose his word very, very carefully. One should focus on the mind and then identify it. So he's going to follow this tradition. So now we go back very briefly to the preliminary practices. And again, I changed the translation a lot throughout this here. With tears flowing, and this term I'd never heard in my life. I thought it must be a typo. And I'm sure he's got it, and I'm sure it's exactly the right word. But if nobody knows what the referent of that word is, then really, I mean, with due respect, I mean, you know, I appreciate people with big vocabularies, but if nobody else knows the word, you may as well just talk in Swahili, you know. And so my words, you'll understand, it's for kind of Buddhism for Dummies approach, okay? With tears flowing and one's hair standing on end. That's what it actually means. Like when you, whether it's like, it could be romantic longing, or it could be passionate spiritual longing, where there's such passionate devotion and gratitude and reverence and so forth, that tears flow and you just feel your hairs going, your body hairs, not the hair on top of your head. Right? That's different. It's a different word in Tibetan. It's bapu. This is ta. This is bu. But y'all know what I'm talking about, right? It's like, just like, okay, you already know. Okay. He's talking about real passion here. With tears flowing and one's hair standing on end while focusing on the guru with intense admiration and reverence. That's a very precise translation. You should make fervent appeals to the guru from the very bottom of your heart for a long time. Okay? So I've commented on that earlier. And just before I walked over here, I saw, because I check out the New York Times regularly, there was one more article on meditation. And I wrote to a friend of mine, because we just go back and forth, and I said, God, from bad to worse. It was, they cited in this article, it's right there, it just came on probably a couple of hours ago, cited somebody, sounds like a Buddhist monk, but I have to say, tragically uninformed. But there he's got the name of a Buddhist monk. You'd assume, oh, he's being written up in the New York Times. He's got a Buddhist monk name. He must certainly know what he's talking about. You want to know what the root of all suffering is? Desire. You want to know what desire is? Desiring things to be different from the way they already are. I just want to go into my room and start crying. I mean, the word bullshit doesn't even cover it. It doesn't even suggest how bullshittish this is. This is orders of magnitude beyond bullshit. This is a herd of bulls all crapping simultaneously into the same cup. I mean, such nonsense. Like, I'm serious here. Like gender inequality, like slavery, like terrorism, like bigotry, like dishonesty, like corruption in the government. The Buddhist response is, well, I don't want anything to be different because I'm desireless. No, you're an asshole. That's what you are. If you look at the world and you don't want, this means you have no compassion. Compassion is wanting things to be different. And that's why I have passion about this. This person is representing Buddhism and he's doing such a bloody awful job of it. It makes all of Buddhism look like it's stupid. In the New York Times, with a person who has a Buddhist monk name. That makes me upset. I don't like that. I do not desire that. I desire that to stop. I wish no harm on anybody. But gosh, this is what they still print. Desire is not... Imagine the Buddha sitting under the tree of enlightenment and not wanting anything to be different. He wouldn't move. The world would go to hell in a handbasket, and the Buddha would say, well, it's not my problem. I have no desire. Oh, I've just made myself absolutely irrelevant to the entire world. So what was the point of becoming a Buddha? To be totally irrelevant. So this is desire. This is passionate longing. This is a desire that overwhelms all other desires. And don't tell me it's not desire. It is, of course. But it's not attachment. It's not clinging. It's not craving. It's not grasping. It's a yearning for freedom. And when we see someone who's worthy of devotion, like the Buddha himself, for heaven's sakes, let the devotion flow. And the aspiration, may I too realize such awakening. And that is certainly a desire. And to snuff out that desire, that's really horrific. To snuff out people's desires to achieve enlightenment, to cultivate virtue, to find greater happiness, and tell them, no, 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 that's a cause of suffering. Oh, it's moronic. So that's it. These are the times we're living in. When that got published, is that something we should take seriously? This is a good account of Buddhism. Amazing. Afterwards, imagine that you are blessed by the Guru dissolving into you. We've covered that. In the midst of evanescent appearances, we've covered that as well. Do not, all the appearances coming to the mind, right? Coming, going, coming, going. Do not contrive anything. Do not make up anything. Don't construct. Don't create anything. Do not contrive, manufacture anything with thoughts such as... thoughts... I just have to modify my own modification. Do not contrive anything with thoughts entertaining such things as... such things as... entertaining... Such things as achieving temporal and ultimate goals and fearing that undesirable events might befall you in the present or future. So that was really core. That was really quintessential. Okay? Here you are. You're settling the mind as a natural state. So don't conjure up any thoughts of your own. You're here to watch, not to enter into the drama. So don't conjure up any thoughts entertaining such things as achieving temporal goals. Like if I meditate really well, I can become a meditation teacher. I'll make a lot of money. I'll get a big reputation, blah, blah. Or ultimate goals. Oh, if I practice this, I'll reach the path. I'll become an Arya Bodhisattva. Maybe I'll become a Buddha. I'll be hearing rainbow body. Okay, that's good, but not now. Don't anticipate future. Not while you're resting there. In between sessions, as I said so many times, between sessions, arouse the enthusiasm, the aspiration, the motivation, call for blessings, supplicate 100 times, all good. But when you're on the spot, on the cushion, doing the practice, leave all that behind. No desires for ultimate, no explicit desires articulated and pursued while you're on the cushion doing this practice. Everything in the future, release it. You're just doing the practice. And you're releasing all hope of achieving temporal and ultimate goals and all fears that undesirable events might befall you in the present or future. So a very pithy statement there. And then more pithy statement. Without following after what has gone before, so don't follow after those thoughts, don't go down memory lane, don't move from the present, without doing that or anticipating what has not come. So no waiting. Waiting is exactly anticipating what may or may not come. Settle for a little while. The words are so carefully chosen. Settle for a little while. When you're sitting down, don't think, okay, I'm not going to be here for an hour. I'm going to be here for an hour, 2 hours. I'm going to be here for 24 minutes. Just have the notion, I'm here for a little while. Then you don't burden your mind with, I wonder if I can sit for a whole 20 minutes or 40 minutes. I wonder if I can go for longer this time. It's more anticipation, more throwing dirt in your gas tank. Okay? So settle for a little while, in equipoise, in the present, devoid of movement. That's a lovely paragraph. Thus, at the time of focusing the mind, you should not cease all mental activity, as if you had fainted or fallen asleep. That is what should be maintained, of course, is discerning mindfulness. That is a type of mental engagement. Maybe mental engagement would be better. I think mental engagement would be better. I'm going to say that. I know the term. It's yilajeba. So you should not cease all mental engagement. In other words, just space out, zone out, you know. Okay, I'm here now. And lose that flow of cognizance. One should not cease all mental engagement as if you had fainted or fallen asleep. So this is a point I've been making all along. Sustain the flow of cognizance. Without being distracted from resting in just that unwavering mind. Without being distracted from resting in just that unwavering mind, you establish from afar mindfulness free of even the slightest forgetfulness. Although the object may be tied with the rope of mindfulness, if mindfulness weakens, there is a great danger that the thoughts of the moving mind will proliferate. So when the power of mindfulness declines, it is necessary to post the sentinel of introspection as to how the mind moves or does not move and focus there. Okay? This is very, very dense. Really clear, but very dense. So, but it's so familiar also, isn't it? Without being distracted from resting in just that unwavering mind, there's the candle, there's the index finger, straight up. You establish from afar, as attending to the, like the shepherd attending to the flock, spread out over the plain. You establish from afar, free of even the slightest forgetfulness. And all the object is tied with the rope of mindfulness. That is, you are engaged, you remain engaged, connected. Although it's still possible, of course, that mindfulness will weaken. You'll fall into forgetfulness or distractedness. And in that case, if that occurs, there is a great danger that thoughts of the moving mind will proliferate. Of course, you'll be carried away. So when the... And I'm going to make a full stop there. Period. So when the power of mindfulness declines, it is necessary to post the sentinel of introspection. It's a much more common metaphor than posting a sentinel of mindfulness. You fasten your mind with a rope of mindfulness to the meditative object and you post the sentry of introspection. Those are more common metaphors. It is necessary to post the sentinel of introspection as to how the mind moves or does not move. That is, the mind here is your awareness of the events taking place. Are you slipping off into distraction or forgetfulness or does not? Mind moves as distracted. The mind does not move. Could be you're non-moving, but you're radiantly clear, or the mind does not move and you're falling into laxity. But you attend there and you focus there. As it is said in Bhavaviveka's Essence of Madhyamaka, The straying elephant of the mind should be bound to the fixed pillar of the object with the rope of mindfulness and subdued by the iron hook of introspection. Classic, classic metaphor. That's for all of shamatha. Okay, the elephant of the mind, very powerful but very rambunctious. You tame this wild, rambunctious mind of yours by fastening it, tethering it to the fixed pillar of your meditative object, which could be a Buddha image, your breath, or anything, with the rope of mindfulness. And as it's still, you know, jerking around, it doesn't like it, it's going to revolt against that. You subdue it with the iron hook of introspection. Okay, classic metaphor. And we continue, moving right along briskly here. In brief, the attainment of flawless concentration, or samadhi, occurs by way of nothing but the maintenance of mindfulness and introspection. That's it. Those are the two tools, the two faculties of mind that you utilize and refine. This is really, I must say, classic Tsongkhapa. He's so clear, definitive, precise, accurate. This is just to rephrase Tsongkhapa. But he's not speaking on his own. He's drawing from these great, great scholars and adepts of classical India. Between mindfulness and introspection, mindfulness is the principle of the two. When mindfulness has arisen, introspection is taught as its result. So it is a derivative. Mindfulness is primary, introspection is derivative. Sustain the flow of mindfulness, introspection will be right there on call. Lose mindfulness, introspection's gone. Now we move back to method two. At that time, once you have blocked all other thoughts, okay, we're back to that cutting them off. And the one thought, so to speak, is I shall continue attending to sheer luminosity and cognizance. That too is a kind of thought, although you're not cogitating about it. You're doing it, and it's driven by the intention. But all other thoughts, out with you. Once you have blocked all other thoughts, when the aware, clear mind is ascertained, okay, well, the aware, clear, that's Selsing Rigpa, that is cognizant and luminous. He's just, and here, mind is consciousness. Okay, this is consciousness focused upon itself, awareness of awareness. And what's the nature of the awareness of which you are aware? It's cognizant and clear, or cognizant and luminous. So when the aware, clear mind, he's just given the defining characteristics of consciousness, is ascertained, you're not just focusing on it, you've identified it. So this, on the relative level, is analogous to the pointing out instructions that you receive when you are a suitable vessel. Optimally, you would have achieved shamatha and had gained insight into emptiness, poised, ready to fully receive and sustain the pointing out instructions, that is, ascertain rikpa and then maintain that flow. But you receive what are called rikpa ngotupe menga, the pith instructions of pointing out rikpa. Okay? And so, if it's to be sustainable, then of course you're coming in with a suitable vessel of a mind very well trained in shamatha vipassana. You can receive pointing out instructions, and there are some lamas who give it, and some of them give it very effectively. And I think it's very worthwhile. It's good to inspire people. We need as much inspiration as we can get. You know, there's so many things to be depressed about, pissed off about, unhappy about, and so forth. We're living in degenerate times in so many ways. That if a lama can authentically inspire people to wish to practice, that's good. And for pure motivation. And I have some lamas in mind when I'm saying this. I think the motivation's beautiful. I have no criticism, nothing to say. Thank you for inspiring people, guiding people with loving kindness, compassion, wisdom, authentic teachings. Good. And there are lamas who, you know, you come to the first teaching and it's weekend teaching and they give you point out instructions on Rigpa. You know, often inspires. How's that just for an objective fact? It often really inspires people. So who would, you know, be complaining about that? Not I. I never do. Can they sustain it? Virtually never. But in a way, so what? Whatever works to inspire people, to encourage people to set out on an authentic path. If they can't sustain it, well, okay. I lead weekend shamatha retreats. And people in a weekend can get a little bit more stability and vividness than they had before. And then they go home. Can they sustain it? Maybe. Probably not. But they can try, and if they really continue, then of course it can get better. But will they, you know, will they sustain the level of stillness and clarity that they achieved in a weekend or a week when they're meditating 5-6 hours a day? And then they're back to working full-time and so forth. Almost certainly not. Does that mean it was a waste of time? Well, if it did, then I would just stop teaching. I don't think it's a waste of time. But so this is intending to point out Rigpa, Buddha nature, which is pretty deep. And not for me to say, you know. Some people may have really quite a profound identification of Rigpa. Not for me to say. I have no way to judge. I have no desire to judge. But that's Rigpa Ngotrupa, pointing out pristine awareness, Buddha nature, primordial consciousness, right? This is pointing out the relative nature of your mind. Like pointing out a pineapple. You know, it's the same level, the same plane of reality. It's conventional reality. Pineapple, an entity in samsara. Consciousness, an entity in samsara. Pineapple has these defining characteristics. Consciousness has this. But in our world, especially the materialistic world we're living in, actually identifying the defining characteristics of consciousness, focusing on it and identifying it, that's a pretty big deal. When so many people are talking about, you know, it's just a function of the brain or an activity, it emerges from chemicals and so forth, then you actually, you don't have to argue it. Say, I don't really feel like debating with you because I actually know what I'm talking about. Because I've observed consciousness, I've identified its salient characteristics. So I have nothing to debate. If you want to believe that, okay, knock yourself out. So, yeah. So observe it. So when the aware clear mind is ascertained, focus mindfulness closely just on its nature. That's its essential nature. I'm going to say essential nature again because it's useful. And observe it single-pointedly and nakedly. You know the word nakedly. Without elaborating, without thinking about it, without labeling, associating, putting all your conceptual junk on it. Just take it straight. It's the taste of lemonade. Just taste it, period. Looking thus, identify every single moment or thought that occurs. This is interesting. Well, this is identify every... So this sounds like you might be doing the two things simultaneously, stillness and motion. You have now established your beachhead, if I use a military analogy. You've established your beachhead. You've come and come to settle your mind in its natural state. Your awareness is resting in its own place. It's vivid. It's self-ascertaining. It's luminous. It's clear. It's still. It's relaxed. And then you let the light of your awareness overflow and illuminate the space of the mind while resting in the stillness. And from that perspective of stillness, you observe the movements. So that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like what he's describing here. Looking thus, identify every single movement or thought that occurs. So now we're not talking about cutting them off. So once he's blocked, it's an interesting strategy. This is all strategy. It's saying, in order for you to establish your beachhead, okay, I hope you, I presume you know what that means if you're not a native English speaker, but you've established your launching pad. It can be helpful at the very beginning, block the thoughts, because every single one that comes up is going to pull you away. So cut them off. Right? You might do that with mindfulness of breathing. That's what mindful breathing is often taught as a preliminary exercise. That's to cut off all those thoughts and just get into a flow of non-conceptual awareness of the breath. 10 breaths, 21 breaths. You've cut them off. And then you found, ha, this is what it's like, you know, seconds on end. Ha. Still, clear, aware of awareness, identifying awareness, knowing awareness. Okay, I'm ready to go. And then let the light of your awareness illuminate the space of the mind or whatever thought comes up. Strategy. Looking thus, identify every single moment or thought, movement or thought that occurs. Doing so, it depends on introspection. Alternatively, as taught in the Vinaya scriptures, because I think it's not just one, I think it's multiple ones, as taught in the Vinaya scriptures, meditate as in a duel between an archer and a swordsman. Now you know that one. When you've aroused the power of mindfulness and introspection, any thought that arises is, at its occurrence, severed abruptly and not allowed to proliferate further. Okay, I guess he really is. He's really focusing on one method here. I thought maybe he was going back and forth, but no, this is pretty much awareness of awareness. So he says you recognize every single thought, but you don't go along with them. You recognize them with introspection. And then we're back to the duel, not the raven. That's letting them, let them be, let them be, let them be. No, the arrow's coming, cut it off. So once you've aroused the power of mindfulness and introspection, any thought that arises is, at its occurrence, severed abruptly and not allowed to proliferate further. That's awareness of awareness. This is definitely the yang approach. When you rest motionlessly after the proliferation of thoughts has been severed, then, without losing mindfulness and introspection, inwardly vigilant, you should relax into the present, relaxing into equipoise. Relaxing, but not losing the flow of very, very sharp, clear mindfulness, cognizance. Machik, the great yogini, says, tightly focus and loosely relax. So this is centuries ago. So she, I don't know if she coined this phrase, but it certainly goes back a long time. Tightly focus and loosely relax, and there the mind is focused. Also, as is taught elsewhere by the great Brahman Saraha, the great Mahasiddha, Indian Mahasiddha, this mind bound up in knots, when loosened, attains freedom, no doubt. So this is the same as before. So I think both Roger Jackson and I should make this homogenous, because it's exactly, he said, bound up in entanglement, remember? Now it's knots. They're both correct. But I think we should homogenize those. Either way, they're fine. But if it's a translation of the same words, then we should give it the same translation. So I'm going to put a little note there just to homogenize. This one's fine. The other one's fine. They're both correct. Oh, wait. Okay, it's now 10 past, so I got carried away. But no doubt. So that's good. It's a nice note to end on. The mind can feel so dense, so constricted, so tied up in knots, right? And the way to find freedom, loosen up. That's why the initial instruction, when you find that your attention is wavering, the first one is loosen up. Relax, then release. Don't try to release before you've relaxed. Relax, then release. It's easier. If you relax first, it's easier to release than if you're still bound up. Right? If you're still bound up and you try to release, that could be a lot of effort. But if you're already relaxed, then the releasing is easy. And if you've released, then it's easy to return. Right? Often we try to skip the first two and just say, return. And that can be very arduous, fatiguing, frustrating, irritating, exasperating. And we don't want that. That's not helpful. Hola, so. That'll do. An orange. I recognize it.